University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents William Pfeffer, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Philosophy at Nebraska Wesleyan, and his lecture entitled Ethics in Medicine, Compatibility or Conflict. Pfeffer, a member of the Wesleyan faculty since 1966, has facilitated classes and seminars on a variety of ethical issues, including the ethics of death, medical issues in ethics, and nursing and ethics. His lecture was part of Nebraska Wesleyan's Mattingly Symposium, which focused on the relationship between science and religion. This annual event brings distinguished scholars to Nebraska Wesleyan for discussion of contemporary human issues. Join us now for University Forum and William Pfeffer.
I'm a little disappointed. I expected at least to have that big seal here on the front. And so they said, get Pfeffer a podium. And the technical department just put this together about 2 or 3 minutes ago. So I don't guarantee how well it'll stay or anything of the sort. I just carried that out for effect. It looked like, you know, you had a lot of things there and you were going to say lots of sort of things. I want to also remind you that there is another session of the Mattingly Symposium yet today at 1 o'clock in the Conestoga Room. And the speaker then will be John Turpin, who's the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church in Oakland, California. That's God's church, of course, because it's Presbyterian, but that's neither here nor there. And he will be speaking on bringing science and modern biblical theology scholarship into the local church. And there will be responding two sterling alumni of this institution, Susan Davies and James Keyser. So that's at 1 o'clock, and I hope many of you plan to come to that. In fact, I would advise you to go now and get a seat early over there if you really want to hear that. Also, you know, I've been attending most of these things, and they are, you know, really super important topics. The day the world changed, speaking of God in a scientific, technological age, Genesis, evolution, creation of the universe, all of these huge, wonderful topics. And they said, well, what can we give Pfeffer? And they said, well, you better make it as specific as possible because he can't handle these large sort of things. But that didn't bother me because I had a professor once who said the less they thought a person knew, the larger topic they gave to speak on. So I think this will all work out all right, maybe. My original title was God, Man, and the Universe, but I changed it. So that gives you some idea. I have to keep looking to see exactly what this title is because they said we need something, and I sent something in, and that was it. But as I got to thinking about it, however, I think this topic is as big and as broad as any that one deals with, because we're going to look at life and death and health in between. And that's a fairly large topic. I want to begin with, I have visions, by the way, of all of these. See, this doesn't meet here. And all of these things come flying all over the place. Something's there. Who cares? Let them fall. I want to begin by reading a few sentences from a book that I urge all of you to pick up and read sometime. It won't take you much over a couple hours to read the whole thing, and that's Norman Cousins' Anatomy of an Illness, as perceived by the patient. And he wrote this: the emergence of specialists was connected to the burgeoning new medical technology, giving many people the impression that the doctor was an auxiliary of the machine. I think that's the most telling part of this. I want to read a couple more sentences, but giving many people the impression that the doctor was an auxiliary of the machine. Patients found it difficult to accept the new impersonalization produced by the new technology. Moreover, the machines pronounced verdicts with a finality that seemed to run counter to one of the oldest rules of medical diagnosis: always allow for the fact that certain individuals may have all the signs and symptoms of a particular disease, yet may be atypical or even completely free of that disease. Let me say at the very beginning, in answering the question of whether the relationship between medicine and ethics is one of compatibility or conflict, that for the sake of our well-being, they need, perhaps must be, compatible. To think that the scientific, technological world of medicine is divorced or in conflict with the world of values and personal worth is to fragment the person and to isolate the disease or illness from the task of treating the whole person. It really isn't, to me, a question of compatibility or conflict. It really is an imperative that if we are to take the whole person into consideration, if we are to respect each other as persons, then these two things must be compatible and not divorced from one another. This morning, I'd like to use...
My goodness.
I can see when I fold my hands like that, you hear me. When I'm like this, you can't hear me. So everybody is saying, don't fold your hands. It doesn't make any difference whether this is on or off, does it really? You can hear me, can't you? I, by nature, have a very soft voice, but I will try to project what is going on here. But I'd like to use as a kind of microcosm to bring out some ethical issues in medicine, end-stage renal disease, better known as ESRD. I think about 2 years ago, I received a call from the Nebraska Kidney Association, and they were having their convention in Grand Island, and they called and they said, would you lead an afternoon session on ethical issues related to ESRD. And I thought to myself, well, it's a good way to get away from school for a couple days. And I said, oh, I'd be delighted to. So I wrote it down, they hung up, and then immediately I picked up the phone and started calling. I had no idea what ESRD stood for. But it didn't take me too long to find out that it meant end-stage renal disease. That is, when you have kidney disease and it is in its end stage. And I want to use this to illustrate how ethical issues and values enter in terms of treatment for end-stage renal disease. If you have this end-stage kidney disease, you have roughly three options. One, you can be put on a hemodialysis machine. Two, there is such a thing as home dialysis that you can do in your home. And then third, there is a kidney transplant. Now, I want to talk about all three of those and raise some ethical issues, or issues at least of value in relation to those three. And you can take these issues and use it as a grid on almost any kind of illness and disease one has. I thought about using as the kind of microcosm critical care units, because these same things would come up there, or any of these sort of issues. Let's look first at the dialysis machine. And right off the bat, when a physician's value system dictates that saving lives is the ultimate goal, then all patients with renal failure may be seen as dialysis candidates. But right away, it's a kind of value system that we are confronted with, along with the fact that we have a machine that can be used. Bless you. Well, she sneezed and then kind of looked like this at me, and I thought, well, I ought to say something. So, all right. It did wake up the person next to her, so that helps. When one is on the dialysis machine, the patient faces several things. In America, one is on the machine for about an average of 3.5 hours, somewhere 2 or 3 times a week. In Europe, the average time on the machine is 4.5 hours. And there are cases in which one, depending on the stage, these latter stages, is on a dialysis machine 6 hours, 3 days a week. Now, that's what the kidney patient faces with end-stage renal disease. Also, there are tremendous dietary restrictions that they have to face. And a number of kidney patients are ready to testify that the diet restrictions are the toughest thing they face on dialysis. There's also the dependency imposed by the treatment itself. And then there are often other physical complications. So all of these things face the patient that is about to receive dialysis on the machine. But it does work. It does give a person for X amount of years, some quality time. Now, the first ethical or value issue I'd like to raise in regards to the dialysis machine is an overall question of the right to health care. Is there such a thing as a right to health care? In 1973, Congress passed the first law in its history mandating money for a medical procedure. And it was for hemodialysis. And it was for the use of the machine. It worked. And yet, it was very expensive. So in 73, Congress passed this law that said everyone who needs this machine is entitled to it. And if insurance or their own money or whatever will not foot the bill, the United States government will. Now, if you ask in the light of that, is there a right to health care? The answer is yes. There definitely is a right to health care if you are using the hemodialysis machine, because it's mandated by law. Number of years ago, Congress passed the Hill-Burton legislation, and it poured billions of dollars into the construction of new hospitals, the expansions of old ones, nursing homes, all of these things. They poured tons of money at very low interest. That's another way of saying that, yes, people have a right to health care. And part of that right is there has to be places for them to go when they are in need of health care. Also attached to that bill was the stipulation that X amount of people in that health care institution had to be those that could not pay for it. Then that's still in effect. If hospital or a nursing home has Hill-Burton funds, they are still obligated to take a certain percentage of people who cannot pay their own way. It was another way of saying, yes, there is a right to health care. Need I mention Medicare or Medicaid? That's another way of saying, in a way, that we do have a right to health care. So that when you're 65 or older, kind of strikes me right here, you are eligible for health care. If your income is below the $12,000 to $14,000 limit, keeps shifting some, why, you are eligible for aid. Now, that does seem to say that we have a right to health care. But what it doesn't say is what kind of or what measure of health care one has a right to. Does that mean that everyone has a right to the unlimited use of all the resources that the healthcare profession has at its disposal? Does it mean that the person who has had two previous transplants, neither of which have taken, now is entitled to a third transplant, while there are 40 people on a list that have not had one transplant? It's one thing to say that, yes, we have a right to health care. It's another thing to say what kind and how much. Does age enter into the equation of the amount of health care? Many of you will remember that Governor Lamb of Colorado got himself in a whole peck of trouble a few years back by, at least as reported in the press, by saying that the older generation has to realize it has a moral obligation to die. You know, because the older generation is getting more and more, and they are using a disproportionate share of the medical resources. And, you know, he got a lot of bad flack for that. Daniel Callahan, who is head of the Hastings Center, has written a book, and it is entitled, Am I My Parents' Keeper? The problem of age and a disproportionate use of health care is a important topic and one that is gaining in the ascendancy, at least in the talking stage. Every time somebody says something like that, ARP rings up the battle flags and mans the bastions and tries to blow it out of the water, of course. And I can't say that's going to change. But you see, age is important in terms of right to health care, in terms of how much and to whom. And is this right to health care, by the way, is it based on diagnosis or prognosis or both? What are these kinds of criteria? And then when you talk about the right to health care, one cannot help talk about cost and what that means in terms of who might or might not get health care. I personally think we have a three-tiered health care system in this country. The first tier are the rich, and the right to health care is immaterial. Isn't a problem. They either have the bucks to pay for it, or they have so much insurance that it's no problem whatsoever for the wealthy. Of course they have a right to health care, because they have the money to afford it. If they want to go to a clinic here or in Switzerland, they can do it. Now, at the other extreme, you have the poor. But they also, in our country, have a right to health care because they are eligible for Medicaid. If your income is below a certain amount, you are assured of some type of health care because the government will underwrite it. Now, again, it doesn't say what kind of health care, how much kind of health care, or the quality of the health care that one might. And we all know horror stories about hospitals and physicians and clinics that if it says Medicare, they say, sorry, we're too busy, we can't handle that. Or some of them are blunt and say, I am not touching Medicare. There's a big sign there that says, leave Medicaid patients outside or something like that. There was a cartoon of in a hospital, and it was there were doors there. And the one was for the wealthy, and there was a door you went through for health care. The other ones that had a lot of insurance. And then there was the one with no health care, and there was a door for them, and it was marked exit. So you see, but at both the bottom and the top tier, there is the availability of health care. It's that middle tier in which we face all kinds of problems. It is estimated conservatively that there are 25 million and probably 30 million people in our country that have absolutely no health insurance or protection whatsoever. Their income is too high to get aid from the government, but not high enough to afford insurance. If you have a family with 2 to 4 children, and you're making, let's say, $16,000 a year, but you have to pay $400 a month for insurance, you can't afford it, so you don't buy it. So when we talk about the right to health care, there are some things that look very clear. And sometimes we can say yes, and we can see all of these things, but That doesn't really answer the question about health care, because there are all sorts of value issues connected with that particular ethical issue. Another ethical issue that the dialysis machine raises, that also applies all across the board, is the right to stop treatment. And this is inextricably bound with patients' autonomy. There was a case of a 14-year-old that was suffering from kidney disease for 2 years. He had had two kidney transplants, one from his father and one from another donor, and they were attempted, but they had no success in either case. And there was a prognosis that gave a strong indication that they would not be successful in the future. So he survived by having hemodialysis 3 times a week. But as certainly some, cannot take this dialysis all that time, and he tolerated dialysis very poorly. He suffered nausea. He vomited a great deal. He had severe headaches. He was constantly weak. And because of all of this, he became depressed. His appetite suffered. And finally, the 14-year-old said, "Stop the treatment. I do not care to go on with this." They had him examined by a child psychologist, and the child psychologist concluded that he did not suffer from any severe psychological disorder, that he was competent in every way to make this decision, to stop the treatment. The parents decided to support the 14-year-old. The hospital and the doctors wanted it otherwise than that. They wanted to continue the treatment. And there, friends, is the moral dilemma. He can be kept alive by going 3 times a week on the dialysis machine, even in the light of the fact that transplants stand very little chance of working. And we can do that. Medicine can do that. But the question is that what ought to be done in this case? And how much autonomy, how much self-choice does one have in their medical treatment? And medicine alone cannot answer that question. But, by the way, neither can ethics alone answer that question. Because to make a decision to stop means that we need at hand to know what medicine can and cannot do in this case. It can keep him alive on a machine. It cannot effectively do a kidney transplant. But you have to know those things. And so here is the 14-year-old, and here is the problem of autonomy, which often is in conflict with the so-called problem of paternalism. And in many places, paternalism is still the prevalent value in medical care. Goes something like this. This is a kind of an extreme case. So if there are any medical personnel in here, you know, don't get out the rope to lynch me or anything like that. But it goes something like this. We, the health care givers, are the holders of a body of knowledge, and because of our education and experience, we know what is best for patients. Patients do not have access to this knowledge. Therefore, they cannot possibly know how to decide as well as the healthcare giver can. And that's the kind of paternalistic value that we often find. And if the patient refuses treatment, then it's simply a sign of that patient not being very intelligent. They don't have these facts. And by the way, in some cases, that's quite true. Patients do make decisions, and they are not very intelligent, you know. Nonetheless, the attitude or the value of paternalism against a patient's autonomy is, in many cases, a very real one. And so we have come up with ways in which to try to establish a person's wishes and ideas based on that person's value in terms of their life or whatnot. And so we have such things as living wills, durable power of attorney in health matters. The unicameral of our state is a fearful and wonderful thing. For years, a living will couldn't even get out of committee, let alone to the floor of the Senate, there to be battered down. Couldn't even do that. This year, lo and behold, not only does the living will get to the floor and is passed, so does the durable power of attorney in health matters. So now, where we had nothing before, suddenly we are twice blessed with both of these. And so don't ask me to explain that, because that would ask me to explain the unicameral. And John Vermeer can't even do that. I've heard him on the tube before, and I testify he cannot explain that. But no, not true, John. But it did. But we ought to have it legalized. Some of you know my personal opinion about living wills, and that is, I don't care whether they're legalized or not. I think they are really only an indication of the patient's wishes. But that's very important, and we have them. The U.S. Congress has mandated every healthcare institution to formulate. In fact, they had to be in place by December 1 last year. So-called advance directives, so that a patient is asked, now look, you're coming in to get a broken wrist fixed. Now we want to give you these advance directives. Now, do you want to be resuscitated if your heart stops beating while we're setting that wrist? And that encourages one to have all the procedures done. But no, that's making fun there, friends. But, by the way, it's perfectly possible for such a thing to happen. And what the advance directives do is allow a patient to say in advance what they want to do. By the way, the hospital or the nursing home or what have you has to make the patient aware of the advance directives. There is nothing that forces the patient to pay any attention to them and fill them out. But at least they are familiar with it. The well, I don't think I had some things to read from the Lutheran Hospital in La Crosse, Wisconsin, about how they go about this business of patient's autonomy, but we don't really have time. I can tell that right now. I am done with my first point of seven. So, it may take a little long. You didn't think you were going to stay for the talk back, did you? You're going to stay through lunch. Let's look at home dialysis a minute. As a kind of microcosm. And all I want to say about home dialysis is that in that process, there is a tremendous need to rely on supportive, responsible, and responsive others. This is done in the home. It takes time. Certain things have to always be in order and sterilized and all kinds of things. And the process has to be gone through. And then again, there's the dietary and all of this. And that won't work unless there are others there that can support them, that can also take some responsibility and can be responsive to the needs of this person. It never can be done in isolation. They have all of the medical know-how and what technology they need to do that. And it can be done at home. By the way, there is a debate in the nephrology division as to how effective it really is. But it's an interesting debate because the opposite side, well, tell me how really effective all of this dialysis is that you do by machine. And both sides have come up with interesting statistics on that. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, but we're not going to worry about it here. Just to say that this points out something that is significant in all medical care. And that is, if we think about it, the support and the responsiveness of others. Sometimes it's our family, the physician, the nurses, the hospital, the insurance company. You see, all of those are involved when you and I have a medical problem. And rather than see ourselves over here in a little compartment all by ourselves, facing this all by ourselves, it's very important for people over here to see that part of the value of that life is not only to cure an illness, but to support that person, to be there for that person, to care about them, so that at isolation booth there with the sickness need not be occupied only by them, but this support group can come over there at the same time and give their support to them. This is particularly a problem in home dialysis. Well, the third thing is a kidney transplant. And we have the techniques and the skill to do it. No question about that. We have research that has developed and continues to develop drugs that aid us in our ability not to reject the organ that is transplanted. Science, research, technology gives us that. We can do those things. We can have kidney transplants. Now, the ethical issue I'd like to raise here is the ethical issue of the allocation of scarce resources. We certainly can transplant kidneys, and most of the time, a lot of the time, quite successfully. There's only one small problem. You cannot transplant a kidney that you do not have. And what we lack are kidneys. And that's a scarce resource. And one of the problems that ethics and medicine face is, how do we allocate these scarce resources? How can we get the necessary organs? One thing we found out, and that is the signing of cards is almost totally ineffective. You know, you've seen those cards that you can sign and say, look, I want to give my good kidneys and so forth and so on. They, across the board, they have found those to be ineffective, and mainly because the family takes care of that card. And it goes in the back door somewhere. It happens time and time again. So getting people to sign cards is not a very effective way of doing it. So what's happened is that we have tried to have the health care provider talk with the patient and the family about the donation of usable organs. And I think it will certainly be the exception if you have to be in the hospital for some procedure that you will not be approached by some health caregiver, mostly the nurse, but not exclusively that, about the donation of usable organs. And hospitals have wised up and know that it is also essential to talk to the family as well as the patient. Another thing that some want, and this is pretty much the case, and that is make brain death the universal criteria of death. You know, there was, 20 years ago, a big battle between respiratory death and brain death. But Princeton University settled all that at a big high-blown conference and called all kinds of wheels in the medical profession there, and they came out in support of brain death. And from that time, the dominant death now is seen as brain death. In fact, California has passed a law that says a physician must sign a death certificate if they meet the criteria for brain death. They don't have a choice. It is a must in California. And so brain death, and of course I think you can see the reason for it. Brain death, the organs have a better chance of being in usable condition than if you have respiratory death. And then we might do as Dr. Thomasma suggested about 5 years ago on this campus during another gathering such as this. His solution is that the U.S. Congress pass a law mandating that upon death, all of our usable organs must be taken from us, those that can be transplanted. And lots of people think he was making a joke, but believe me, he was not making a joke. He's dead serious about that, to use that word, sort of in two senses. I didn't really plan that, but inspiration comes like that sometimes. I've been hoping anything would come. But that's possible, but you and I know that it simply isn't going to happen. So we can talk about allocation of scarce resources, and we have them, but the real question is, to whom are these resources to be allocated? Or how are these resources to be allocated? And then we look and see, well, now, can we do it by medical criteria, diagnosis, prognosis? Do we do it by some kind of social criteria, contributions they've made in the past, contributions that a person might make in the present if they had this? Again, we're back to the problem of age. Do we do it on the basis of first come, first serve? Or shall we have a lottery? And somebody needs a kidney, and we have a lottery, and you draw, and you need a kidney, and your number comes up 721. Well, so much for the lottery system. But, you know, any number, but this is the problem. How are you going to do this? Who ought to get these things? And you can see the whole thing. Well, I wanted to talk about informed consent, because that's the very first ethical problem faced in renal disease, and leave it to someone who teaches philosophy to leave to the end that which should be first. But I thought, well, this would make a blazing finish. But unfortunately, time isn't going to allow me to even sputter out, I think. But I do want to say that we could ask the question, who cares for the sick? And think about the answers that we can give. Healthcare personnel care for the sick, the doctors, the nurses, the technicians, the researchers. Hospitals care for the sick. Nonprofit, for-profit. Oh, it'd be a nice topic, but no time. The government cares for the sick. Insurance companies care for the sick. Look, give a round of applause to the insurance company, because they did something that the patient on their own never was successful doing, and that is the second opinion. Now, all you have to do when you go to the doctor is say, well, my insurance company requires a second opinion. Say it whether it does or not, because that's the way to get a second opinion. And it's very important, but insurance companies do care for the sick. But you know who else cares for the sick? You and I do. The person cares for. We can talk about the patient's autonomy, but we also and talk about the patient's right of self-determination. But if we have the right of choice, we also have the responsibility to be concerned with our own health. To help secure our own wellness, we need both medicine to cure and preventive medicine. If life is valuable, if our living is worth something, then we need medicine to cure and medical knowledge to help us engage in preventive remedies. You and I want to be well and whole. But to really be well and to be genuinely whole, medicine and values must complement each other. They must be compatible. The word is trust. Because often with trust comes communication. And if we can talk to one another, then we may be able to look at the whole person and see the person never as a means to some end, but as Kant says, always as an end only. I say, thank God for medicine, but I also say, thank God for ethics. Thank you.
Today's guest on University Forum was William Pfeffer, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Philosophy at Nebraska Wesleyan. His lecture was entitled Ethics in Medicine, Compatibility or Conflict. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent, coeducational, undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.